Hello, my name is RJ Jackson, and I'm interviewing for the Rick and RJ Collaborative. I'm talking to Erica Felicella at her home, of all places, and she is a photographer, a local Dallas photographer. And how do you do, Erica?
I'm doing very well. Welcome to my casa in the lovely Oak Cliff.
Thank you very much. I wanted to immediately just get straight into being a self-taught artist, which is something that's cultivated. It's not like you... Did you get any formal training at all, like, later on?
Not so much. I had a little bit of training. I did take photography in high school, which is when I got bit by the bug. I went on to college to study something totally different. I was a bio major, and never finished. And then basically I picked up a camera again when I was in my early 20s living here in Dallas, and got bit all over again and took off running from there. And I was basically taught, my education was through the commercial photography industry.
Mm-hmm.
I had a regular customer of mine that was the studio manager of a local photographer here in Dallas, commercial photographer, and I just got very lucky, and she referenced me, and before I knew it, I was assisting and working and reading books every single night. I had this philosophy that if somebody ever asked me what I actually knew, I would tell them the truth. If they did not ask, then I would just study every night and make sure that whatever was questionable the day before was not a questionable area the next day. And I had to do that repeatedly for a long time. And I taught myself in the night. I taught myself about composition, lighting, commercial lighting equipment, all the different cameras. And just as I jumped into photography, digital was starting to make a big appearance. And so I had to also study all that new technology and get myself up to speed as quickly as possible.
Well, so because of the different formats, I mean, is it rather like learning it all over again? Or I mean, do you suppose that the film training set you up really well for the digital?
A camera works as a camera works. That doesn't change. F-stops are still F-stops. Shutter speed is still shutter speed. And believe it or not, we still use these archaic thing called light meters on set, and that hasn't changed. There's a lot of other information that you need to know about file integrity and all the hooty-hoo that used to be, you know, Kodak's job, or the film manufacturer took care of all that technical data, and now we need to know a little bit more information. But I'm by no means the utmost pro in all that area. It's a ever-going process, and it's an ever-learning experience.
So even to this day, if somebody asked you what you knew...
I'd probably have to be honest and say, well, I know what I know today.
Well, now you've got a rather full body of work. I mean, all you have to do is just hand it to them.
Yeah.
I currently am going through on my lap here is a sizable and impressive broad body of work.
Yeah, I don't think I will ever claim to be a master. It is a profession that I love for various reasons, and one of them is you never will know it all, ever.
And if you're wealthy, you don't have to tell anybody.
Yeah.
That's why it's the...
Well, unfortunately, that may never be the case, so therefore I will have to answer the question. But I truly love being an artist. It's taken me many years to be able to say that comfortably, the word artist, and associate it to myself. But the thing that I love most about it is that I am a person that falls in love with everything. Something walks past my way and I want to learn how to do that, or what is that? And the beauty of art is that that's exactly what it is. It's limitless, what areas you can study, what areas you can research. And so my body of work is very vast in that sense. There's common themes that tie it together. But
if there's a question of choice in terms of what you absorb. You know, I always say that art is sort of a mix between skill and vision, and you can't have all of one and not the other. Or you can't only have either skill or vision, you know, like Bob Ross would be skill. Or
everybody loves a good happy tree.
Well, everybody loves a good happy tree, but I mean, nothing that he ever did was groundbreaking. It was just pretty, and it was nice. And, you know, I'd love to be able to do that myself, but I wouldn't consider myself really shooting for the stars if I was one of those Bob Ross painters. I'd be over at the Trade Center or something like that, have some sort of gaudy carved frame around it. But, you know, it is a matter of the metamorphosis, but the evolution of an artist. Say, for instance, if you're a painter, photographer, and so forth, that is what defines you. So, but you know, how many years is this over? For instance, this book.
That particular book, I think the oldest image in there is from 5 years ago. So we're looking at roughly the last 5 years. There's lots of different types of work. I've dabbled in pretty much any medium I can actually get my hands on, and I have other colleagues that have taken me aside and showed me their process. And in turn, I've tried to introduce it into my own work. The book that you're looking at, though, is primarily photography and digital art based. But you know, I call myself a photographer because it is the medium of choice. It is the medium that I am the most educated in, and that I have worked with the longest. But I don't think that there is a particular medium that I will reside in forever.
Well, I mean, which one are you most closely associated with in terms of fascinated with or involved with?
That's just it. I mean, I absolutely love painting. I love abstract work. The Dadaists were like one of my favorite periods of art. What I love about being a self-taught artist, and I may have loved it being an academia-based artist as well, but I don't know because I never went that route, is that it's an ever-growing, ever-learning. I'm constantly finding new artists, new types of mediums that I didn't know existed the day before, and therefore they're one of the new things that I am motivated by.
And soon enough, or you may already have invented something in your own right. I couldn't understand the context because there's so much photography in the city. Dallas is a very alive city in that sense. But I do notice that a style that is very something that I consider very important for me currently, it's especially in the days of digital photography, is that you arrange your photographs. It's not so much catching a random moment. You go out to a bar, you take 150 random photographs, and then you stick with the one that looks nicest.
Yeah, my process is typically, I mean, I do a lot of anthropological studies and subcultures and do some photo essay work, and where there are thousands of images, and I will edit down. But my approach that I dig the most is conceptual-based work, and that is a much slower, more tedious process getting to the end product. And that starts with a thought or an idea, and then, of course, you have a list of problems facing that idea, how you bring it to a single image. And then, whether it be on the small scale or the large scale, if I go with a large scale, then I have to decide, is this shot on location? Is it shot in the studio? Okay, well, if it's location, then I have to drive around and find just the right location for the thought. If it's in the studio, I have a little bit more leeway, but then I have to also have a little bit more dollar, and I'll have to build out a set and then dress the set and get everything. I love to work in the studio because it is a much more controlled environment, and you can literally create any thought that you may have, any idea that you want to convey. You can handcraft it down to, you know, what's sitting on top of the table next to the person. Everything is under your control. And I do enjoy that work the most. But there really isn't, as long as I get to approach any type of subject matter that I am interested in at the time, whether it be conceptual, whether it be shot on the street, or whether it be, you know, just by whim. I just love the world of photography, and that is why it is my media of choice at the moment.
Yeah, I can't, I'm kind of a snob when it comes to a lot of art, especially just you name the media. The reason being that I have a term called randoma, in which that's when somebody just throws something together and then they justify it and bullshit their way through an explanation of it. They basically take on the role of an audience member of some random smattering or some off-angle, out-of-focus, close-up shot that's undeterminable, and then they could just sort of fill in all of the blanks. And what you talk about, you have to set the table in a particular way, you have to choose what they're wearing, where the clock is going to go, will the wire be in the wall or will it be protruding from the bottom? And there's a premeditation to that, and maybe just even more of a professionalism, and it gives me a better idea of an artist that, or it gives me more of an impression that the artist has a plan, and that they have an individual outlook and an approach that's a little more honest. And especially with the age of digital photography, because back in the days of film, and I think we talked about this before, back in the days of film, you know, it was an expensive ordeal. It wasn't something that you took lightly. If you wanted to pursue photography, you better be ready to, well, I mean, you had to deal with a red room, you had to deal with development now. Say, for instance, I know somebody who has a camera, he's obsessed with a damn thing, about $2,000, which is still pretty expensive for a camera. And this $1,000 lens, he uses it for, you know, family photographs and just anything. I mean, he works and mechanics, and so he takes pictures of parts and stuff. But it's a camera that's way beyond what he needs. But they're beautiful photographs, of course, just because of the sheer detail of it in comparison. But you can take 500, 600 photographs. And let's say that you're a very shitty photographer. I don't know what your ratio would be, but one out of every 150, as I'll stick with that figure. One out of every 150 photographs, you can't help but it's going to look pretty damn good. It'll have a tasteful, or, you know, it could be completely accidental or random, but that's how they'll get by. And of course, I think of like that classic image of the fashion photographer that's just sitting there and clicking away at the supermodel. And that's why I find that I've become a little more, even more astringent about photography, about when I see it, it has to look premeditative and not randoma in the sense that they're getting away with murder.
But some of my favorite work that that I love, you know, it's of course you go to, if you had to go on the conceptual side, my favorite photographers are Gregory Crutzen, Jeff Kern, who's here locally, Cindy Sherman. They did a lot of conceptual premeditated work, and some of it's very elaborate. But the photography that got me hooked is street photography. There is an art to walking and snapping. There's just an art to it, and the people that are just superior at it, whether they shot 1,000 shots or not, there's a definite art to it. And there's also a mindset and a certain type of person that it takes to go out into the masses and get great work. Although many people, I talk a lot, I meet a lot of people, I am an incredibly shy individual. I do not like to intrude with my camera. I have done it once, where I was actually asked to leave a place, and because of that incident, I have not gone back to shoot that particular type of work ever again, because it still makes me sick to my stomach. So it's not so much that I may not have become a street photographer. I mean, I understand the qualms that people have with digital photography today and people snapping a lot, and I have some issues with it as well. We all do. But there's a definite art to it, and people that can see that quickly, composition that quickly, I admire. I mean, it's...
And hell, one out of every five photographs is a masterpiece. I mean, and I've known certain photographers, you know, throughout my adulthood so far, that really, if they're focused on it, they can't take a bad photograph. And they have the skill, and they have the vision, and they can actually see something. And I understand the apprehension in terms of taking a photograph of a complete stranger. And not just the homeless, but, you know, but taking, you know, a couple, you know, a miserable couple sitting and having lunch at a cafe. I was a videographing, or whatever the hell, taking a video the other day of this march. It was over there. Well, they were marching on the street, but I didn't want to look at the march. And of course, the march is obviously there, and passing all of these cafes. And what I wanted to do was to sit there and look at all of the people sitting at the cafes and standing at the bars and gawking and staring. And that's what I thought, that there would be more truth in that, but I'm still just sort of actively avoiding and aiming it at them and looking away, because I'm afraid if they notice, they're going to think something. I mean, especially in such a situation, being tied into an event like that. I mean, better yet, just being people that just want you to mind your own business.
Yeah, if I'm out shooting, if I do want to shoot on the street or whatnot, I am known to deliberately chop off people's heads in photographs and get all the information without identity of strangers.
So just like the positioning of the rest of their body?
I will deliberately frame up the image without revealing someone's entire identity in a photograph. Or if I want to be really sneaky, I'll take a waist level viewfinder, and people, those cameras used to be around all the time, the twin lens, or even, you know, I have an RZ, but I have to hold it down at my waist to focus, and so it doesn't look like I'm pointing it directly at somebody, because I'm staring down instead of at them. And I feel a little bit more comfortable like that, but in a way I'm actually being incredibly sneaky, because whether that's a good thing or not, I don't know, but it makes it a little easier for me to go out and shoot in the street.
But it's mainly just because of how they would react, not so much that you are, it's not so much about having respect for their anonymity.
It is, in a way for me, it actually is about respect. That's why I went on a project, a self-funded project, where I spent a significant amount of time with this subculture, and I didn't take a single photograph of people for an entire week. All I did was talk to them as me and let them know what I was going to do, and then finally after a week, because I wanted them to be comfortable with me, I didn't want them to think, like, because a lot of people, when you're taking pictures, if you're taking snapshots with a basic camera, people don't get leery about it, but when you have you put a big honking lens on in front of something, and it tends to make people nervous, and they want to know what you're doing or why.
Or where is it going to hang?
Exactly. What are your intentions? And so I really try to be as respectful as possible of anybody that I photograph, and I want them to be comfortable, because if they're not comfortable, then I'm not getting who they actually are.
Well, there's no honesty. There's the apprehension. I mean, I deal with the same thing in recording some people. When they know they're being recorded, they behave far differently than the type of person that I talked to in the first place that said, hey, I'd like to record you. And, but I will admit, I don't have much of that respect that you talk about, but I'm not a professional photographer as much as you are.
But I admire the people that can get out there and literally just go for it. But like I said, it's a totally different type of person than I am. And, I admire them for their work, and I do mine totally,
But I mean, how do you suppose they get any honesty out of it? Is it just by being sneaky?
Some people, they work so fast that it's almost like it's going to sound horrible that I'm going to say a drive-by shooting, but drive-by shooting with cameras,
yes,
is essentially what it is. You know, they can get in and get out and get what they need. Telephoto lenses have helped a whole lot. You can shoot great quality images from far away.
Yeah, you're not setting up a tripod, 10 feet from
No,
them.
It's definitely, we've come a long way from the Ansel Adams days where you had to, throw a big black cloth over your head and have a tripod, and it was very obvious at that point because it'd take you forever to take a photograph. But now, with the technology, you can get into a situation and shoot amazing images without disrupting the scene.
Yeah, I was speaking of Ansel Adams. Do you feel as though you have a novelty yet?
Novelty? You should describe that a little bit more. What do you?
Well, Ansel Adams' novelty is the black and white photographs,
sure,
of canyons and mountain range.
Do I have a niche? Is what you're
Yeah, I mean, because usually somebody as involved as you are has like some at the very least just some great big thing that you're building up towards. That by the time you get to your 50s, you'll have had some theme. Like if Hitchcock were Suspense, or if Terry Gilliam was Dreams and Insanity.
I have not necessarily a one theme, but I have a definite, there's a bin in my office that I keep journals in, journals that are full of concepts and directions and large scale projects. They're all there. My work for the next however many years I get to do this is sitting in my office, and it continues to grow every week. I know exactly where I would like to go and where my work is going to end up. I do feel at this point in my career as an artist that I am barely scratching the surface. I am not entirely living up to my potential as to what I am truly capable of.
But everybody thinks that.
No, but I actually know it, and because I feel it. I mean, I know that, and it all boils down to resources. If we had more resources, if I had this, but instead of whining about it, I continue to produce work that pushes the bar a little further every time. And through the rate of sustainability or sustainable growth, I will get there eventually.
And by the time you get there, it might have come into further fruition. I mean, it might
exactly
firm in to a degree. I mean, I have projects that I've had since I was 19 years old that wouldn't be nearly as good. Of course, they wouldn't be twice as long, thankfully. An unfinished project that's even bigger because it's had so much time on the shelf that every time you give it a little bit of a thought, there's that moment of there's a possibility for epiphany instead of just getting the damn thing done.
Yeah, it grows. Indeed. But a lot of my projects, they mean so much to me, and they're so they're things that I care about deeply. And I just will not proceed with a large-scale project unless I know that I can execute it in a manner that I will be pleased with. And that I am incredibly difficult to please when it comes to my own work, as every artist I know is. And there's not a single body of work I've ever put up on a wall where I felt like it was 100% complete.
Oh, and even if it was at the time, you'd look at it 2 years later and you'd just, you know, bite your tongue or your lip or whatever, that would be your fist. I do notice that you interject yourself into a lot of your photography.
I do, yeah.
And
well, my photography, in a lot of ways, I deal with the, you know, the issues of the human condition, and a lot, and a mental approach to life, and about decisions we make, and just humanness. And the easiest way for me to approach that subject is, and the most honest way to approach that subject is to use myself as the reference point.
You work for free, right?
I do. I never need to sign a model release, but if myself asks myself to do so, I'm pretty sure.
I've never seen a photograph of you in one of your photographs that was vain or exploitative. So you did it right.
Well, I mean, I don't. You know, a lot of these subject matters, like the images that you're looking at specifically, there's one particular image where there's a big hand coming down, sweeping away a bunch of poker chips, and there's a little me trying to push up against the stack. And I could get somebody else to stand in for that, but that's a personal piece of work. It's about, you know, when you've made really bad decisions in your life that tend to feel much larger than you are as a person, you will fight as hard as you can to take it back, but because they are larger than you and you've already thrown it out there in the world, the chips are going to get swept off the table whether you like it or not. And so...
And why not have it be you?
Well, it is, you know, it's a direct affirmation that I acknowledge that I am human and that I definitely make plenty of mistakes. But when I do have other subjects in my images, I try to put a little backstory in them that the viewer... If somebody just walked up and viewed my work off the street, they wouldn't necessarily know any of this information. One of my images in the front there, it's a corporate boardroom, and all the men are wearing Elizabethan dog collars, which is essentially, you know, when your dog has surgery, those big collars that's where they knock around and they bump into everything. The trick about that particular image is that I grew up around corporate America. The man standing at the head of the table is actually my father. And all the men sitting at the table, in their own right, run their own businesses respectfully. And that's the type of side story I like to put into my work. That fulfills it more for me.
Well, I mean, what I like is it's stark imagery, but it leaves enough that it's comprehensible, and it's not just somebody sticking. Well, we were interviewing a painter not too long ago, and she's somebody who works in very ethereal painting. She has an art gallery on Dragon Street, and I was talking about how people have a tendency to interject stark imagery almost as a cop-out. They'll throw in, like, the KFC logo or the Virgin Mary. But this is actually far more, I don't know, it's more accomplished as far as I'm concerned. I mean, what is there any particular meaning on the actual conference table? Is a bunch of, well, stemmed water glasses that are turned upside down on napkins?
Well, it's just it's as if the meeting never really began in the first place.
Yeah, empty pads.
Yeah, it's all about a blocking communication. It's called corporate static, and it's all about feeding through the static to try to get to the actual point. And it's not necessarily... I'm not, you know, so much anti-corporate, but I am... I do like clear lines of communication. But that, you know, that piece could fall into just about any situation in life. I just like to use humor, and I like to poke fun at things from time to time.
Yeah, I think it's the suffocating politeness of corporate America that bothers me so much. And of course, the use of these collars is so that they don't tear away at their wounds. But I don't know. I'm not gonna put any meaning forth into it. I mean, actually, I think it's just wonderful when I can actually sit down with somebody and they can talk about a piece of work they've done and actually know what the hell it means. I notice that you have a tendency towards photographing women as aside from men.
I shoot a lot of men, too. In that book, I noticed when I put it together that I didn't put a whole lot of men in it. Just about everybody that I photograph in my personal work are people that I know. And I just happen to be surrounded by an enormously fantastic group of gals. That black and white series, I did a series called Shots. I wanted to approach the idea of capturing human expression, uninhibited human expression. And I was trying to figure out a way, because the camera You know, I get, me and the dentist, I'm pretty sure, like, I hear more often than not, I take horrible photographs, I can't stand having my picture taken, it makes me uncomfortable. So I was trying to approach all these ideas. And so, what makes people happier other than offering a free bar, essentially? And so, there were 7 categories of liquor. Now, I didn't get people absolutely drunk, but they did take a shot on camera, and that's why the project is called, it's shots of people taking shots. And they came back several times and went through the lists of liquor that I chose for the project, and I captured the moment directly after consumption.
Yeah,
and it's not just women that I've shot. I've shot over 50 people for that project, and when I mean, like, I put a little something special in all the projects just for me, you are not a part of that project if you are not personally in my life. Or in my life at that time, so I know every subject personally that is in that body of work.
Well, yeah, and I particularly like that kind of that type of environment of a close knit group of artists, especially in a local scene or a city. Where are you from?
Oh well, that's a tricky question. I claim to be a Yankee. I'm going to be the first one to admit it, and I'm saying it now on a recorder. And
Wait, how long?
I know. Well, here I'll tell you this story.
Because you might be safe. Yeah,
I am actually. I should start saying I'm a transplanted Texan at this point. I have been living in Texas since 1993. I lived in San Antonio before this. I moved to Dallas in 2000. Prior to Dallas, I lived in New Hampshire, and I was in New Hampshire from, I believe, 1986 to 1993. So, I call New England my home just because the guts of your childhood for me were spent up there.
It's your origin.
Yeah, I love New England. I was born in New Jersey. I've lived in Ohio. I have lived in Minnesota. I've lived in San Antonio twice. All over the country for the most part. But I was on my way to Dallas for a very short visit, and that was 9 years ago. So, I think I'll be here a while.
It's quite a short visit.
Yeah.
I know, but I mean, do you figure that there is still a lot left? I mean, really? I mean, in the city of Dallas, I've been here for about 6 years, and I don't think I've quite hit my limit yet. Of course, I came from Austin before this, and then I came from a town of 10,000 when I was growing up. So it seems as it's always been expanding, but somebody who has experience with San Antonio, which is now the biggest city in the state, and I don't really know how large of communities you lived in up there.
It's very different. San Antonio is still, as large as it gets, it will forever be a small town. It's kind of the mental mentality of the city itself. But I knocked San Antonio a lot when I lived there, but the art community that they have down there is amazing, and it's growing, and they've gained so much recognition. I should have paid a little closer attention when I was there, but when I moved to Dallas, I wasn't quite ready. I literally embarked on my journey as an artist, which is what I plan to do for the rest of my life. After I moved to Dallas, I was kind of floundering and a bit lost when I moved here.
Is it flourishing still? I mean, the art community right
sure,
now?
Sure, I mean, you know.
I mean, due to the economic stuff, I'll probably be asking a lot of people about
that. That's a tricky question across the board for anywhere in the city. I talked to, just this last weekend, and I won't say much about it because for various reasons, I went and auditioned for a new reality television show on Bravo that is for contemporary artists. And so I met artists from all over the East Coast, mostly because I was in New York. The weird part of that story is that the woman standing 2 people in front of me happened to be from Oak Cliff as well. We did not know each other, and we now know each other because we stood in the same line.
Well, you're in the neighborhood.
I know, and we happen to be neighbors, which is just very random. But it's kind of a struggle across the board for just about everybody right now. Being an artist in times of a recession, being a gallery owner, being a, you know, it's going to be tough. But at the same time, if you want to stay as positive as we can about it, there's going to be some amazing work made
Oh yeah,
in this time frame.
I mean, even inspired by the current situation.
Exactly.
It's like, I've been meaning to go out and shoot all of those empty car lots and abandoned buildings, because there's just so much of it. You don't see it right now. You're not seeing it in films. You're not seeing it in photographs. You're not seeing it depicted or told in, like, through a fictional sense or as a backdrop. So, speaking of, though, I mean, you do suppose. You would probably know better than I do, because you're more ingrained in the art community of Dallas. That is there a disparity between the people that are just lucky enough to be hanging in Highland Park living rooms and foyers, and then just the rest of them that toil around until they get discovered?
What do you mean? Do the other artists feel that way? Do I feel? I mean,
well, they're just sort of people. I mean, there's so many different galleries. So you could be hanging at a cafe. You could be hanging at a hair salon, but you could also be hanging at the Craighead Green.
Exactly.
And that there is kind of. I would venture to say that there is a disparity in terms of the exposure, the esteem, the reputation of the gallery, and that I don't really know how far apart those types of venues are, or if it's just a big gray area that goes from black to white.
I've been asking myself this question quite a bit frequently. I show. Lots of different places. I show, you know, I'm showing on Dragon Street this Saturday. I also happen to be up at a coffee shop that's on Cedar Springs currently right now. And
which coffee shop?
At Bewley.
Oh, really? Yeah, I've seen your work at Bewley.
And then I have another piece that's going up to a coffee shop in Addison. And it's to each his own for what artists want to do and where they want to put their work. I'm sure we all aspire to be in particular venues. It is difficult, and the tricky part about art is you have to, A, honor your craft and do the best that you can with your brain, with your skills, and grow and evolve as an artist, but you also have to, and this is the thing that I know that I struggle with, and I'm getting better with it every year, is you have to be an excellent marketer and understand the professionalism to the side. I mean, art, to be an artist, it's a profession. And with, like, any profession, you have to have all the marketing tools behind it.
The business card, the website.
Yeah, and I have all these things, and they're growing, and now we have social networking as a huge part of what we do, and just the interactive environments. There's so many, but that's playing a large part in it, too. And so artists... What I think now is that the artist that is hanging in a coffee shop, actually, if they do the research and they do the work, they have a better chance at approaching galleries now than they did before all these things existed. But I'm all about alternative art spaces and just putting art up everywhere. You know, why not?
And speaking of, just for reference, as inside, what gallery, where in Dragon Street?
HCG Gallery is having a group show called Summer Selections. It opens on Saturday.
Awesome.
So, I was asked to be a part of that, and I'm very honored to put my work up in that space. But, I mean, the plight of the artist, the you know, for me personally, of course we're all looking for some sort of break, but... For me, I have to put the struggle aside in my brain and stay focused on the fact that I do this because I have to, which, I mean, that sounds kind of painful, but I literally have to make work. I have to. It is my release. It is my dialogue with the world, with myself. Most importantly, the dialogue with myself. If I don't get this information out of me, then it spirals inside me and it will consume me. And so I do this because I have to.
Oh, I know the feeling.
And I can't imagine just not creating at any point.
But I would suppose that the best artists are the ones that cannot help it. You know, not the Bob Rosses or the people that would hearken to just, I'm going to go to an art college to learn how to be an artist. But people who cannot help themselves. And of course, as you were talking about, we started out talking about self-taught artists. And the reason I encourage self-taught artists, if I was talking to students, if I was talking to children, 12-year-olds, 16-year-olds, I would say that self-taught art is probably the best way to go. Because if you aren't, you know, if you aren't taught to paint like Rembrandt, and if you just go and paint, you cannot help but be original. It might not be as good, and it won't look as good to people because people are accustomed to the look of Rembrandt or Bruegel or Michelangelo. But you cannot help but be original. Now, if you just sit there and hone at that and work at that long enough and glean from things as you've done, you know, your environment, not necessarily thievery, but just elements of the other things that people are doing and certain details and approaches that other people have that are inspirational, and it's sort of, you know, snowball. And I would say that that's just, I can't think of a better way.
Well, and I'd like to think, you know, this. I used to have the non-academia chip on my shoulder. It was quite big, and it was consuming me. I've gone through several periods of getting a bit snarky and trying to dial that back and you know, settle myself again and acclimate myself with what my actual beliefs are as an artist. And the whole self-taught versus academia, debate is that if I had the chance to do it all over again and start school all over again, I would go to art school.
Yeah.
And the reason I would go to art school is because the training that you receive, the trial and error that goes into my work and the mistakes that I make are very costly. And if you could get a mixture of both, you know, a self-taught environment, which if you are an artist when you get out of art school and you are surrounded by your peers, then it is a self-taught world from that point on. The minute you receive that piece of paper, you are on your own. And you have to teach yourself everything else that you're going to learn. That's just the way it goes. So every artist in their own right is self-taught. We just get, you know, we start with training wheels and school takes the training wheels off. And when we're done with school, we're able to ride the bike.
Yeah, and you don't have to deal with as many mistakes, as many costs. And not the kind that are, you know, that are in the midst of making a project and, you know, this thought comes into your mind that you hadn't intended, but like a serious screw up that probably costs you hours of repair or having to start all over again.
Well, and I made I started freelance curating years ago, and I started freelance curating.
What is freelance curating?
Well, I freelance. I don't belong to a specific group or an established gallery or whatnot, but basically I coordinate shows. I work with artists directly, and I help get them venues and show their work. And I started doing this stuff before I even knew what the word curator was or meant. I had no idea, I've done that with every aspect of my career. Like, I move into a room, and I'm given a task, and then later I get the definition of what the heck it is that I just did. And so that's kind of the self-taught approach, is that, and for me personally, there isn't a single thing in this world that I do not fear. There isn't a single thing in this world that does not make me nervous. I just am able to put on, a very strong facade.
But you are aware that fear is universal.
Oh, definitely. And I'm grateful for the fact that we all fear. But, you know, it's like if I was able to have gone to art school, if I knew and I was honest with myself when I was younger that that's what I wanted to do, I would have had a little bit. The education is priceless.
I'm not at all against academia.
No,
it's only
no.
when somebody hangs their hat on it. If you were going to hang your hat more on academia, or more on inspiration and your own muse, I would choose the muse by 60-40 majority.
Sure,
or what
sure,
have
sure.
You.
And I find that a lot of artists, you were talking about when you're trained and you're looking at, you know, the masters that came before us, that it's almost impossible for it to not start mimicking a little bit into your own work because it's what you're seeing every day. But, you know, I deal with the same thing. When I work with a particular, you know, I spent so many years assisting. When I worked with a particular photographer for so long, it was never intentional, but their sense of self would work their way into my work, and I had to have to kick it out and start over. And it's very weird because the work that I was shooting years ago is kind of what I'm coming back to now, and that was truly me in the beginning. And I went through many different phases, and it's not necessarily mimicked after other people's work, but it's mimicked after the education of new mediums. And now I've been able to introduce myself back into all those processes, but it's.
Yeah, I mean, there's still maybe shreds of debris that are, you can claim ownership over, and yeah, I guess that's part of the process, isn't it? No, I'm a pretty shitty photographer, to be honest. I'm still lost in that thing where you get too close to something and you can't quite know what it is, out of focus stuff, because it's so easy to hide behind that kind of thing. And you know, you look at this body of work, at least in this portfolio, and these are just different projects altogether.
Yeah, it's a true mixture.
And just different tools, different textiles. As though you would, it's the same eye, but you started with a fresh approach each time. And of course you have your, drawers full of the other ones.
Well, and I think that being trained in the commercial world, which is incredibly helpful for me, I am a process junkie. I love to go from A to B to C. My brain usually starts at Z, and then I have to work it way back, but then I love getting everything in my mind set and in order. And commercial photography is a lot like that, and dealing with larger productions, and that has trained me and taught me how to execute my work in a manner. And so I like to try to be as precise as possible. And I do. By the time I have a camera in my hand, the image is essentially finished before I touch the camera. And by the time I get to that point, it should be simple, like just like taking a walk, one foot in front of the other until you get to your destination. So that's my approach.
Well, I don't know. See, in my opinion, that's pretty much the best approach for anything. I mean, there are people that sort of rely on happy accidents. If you take, and I use a lot, not to use too many filmmaker examples, but you know, the way that, say, for instance, I mentioned Terry Gilliam earlier, or David Lynch. I mean, they'll be in the course of making a movie and write a completely new scene in the midst of everything, or there'll just be some detail. I was watching a documentary about the making of Tideland, which was a movie he made about a little girl. And just the way that a scene would be composed over time, and he had a very clear idea, but he always kind of strayed from the storyboards and just a little bit. He would just completely rewrite the situation because he felt that, you know, they'd have a food fight instead of just sitting there having a picnic, or maybe like the famous pie fight in Dr. Strangelove that never made it. But so you're saying that it is a premeditative and specific enough that by the time you are in the process of making it, there's no guesswork involved.
Yes, but at the same time, you said the phrase perfectly, the happy accident, or, you know, I may be on location, and I'm shooting, and I look to my left, and sitting on a chair is this red scarf, and I look in front of me, and I think, ooh, and I have to grab that red scarf, and I run out there, and I throw it on whatever person, and then I might move the whole scene at the last minute around, and that's the shot.
And because you have to balance it out with the new element.
Well, exactly, and I love spontaneity, but I also love process. Spontaneity sometimes gets you some of your best work, but that's just like inspiration on the fly.
And spontaneity hides a lot of bad artists too. But yeah, and that's probably just one of the most exhausting things about a lot of art that I see, is just that the lack of what you're talking about, that specificity, premeditation, and
David Lynch, I mean, like, he is very specific. He knows.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. No.
He knows exactly what he wants, but at the same time, like, when you're in the moment of something, it's just like when you're in the middle of a conversation, you may have started out with an idea of where you wanted to go in that conversation, but, you know, say somebody crosses their legs in a different manner or something is said in that conversation, and before you know it, that tangent takes you to the place that's magic.
And even in the midst of surrealism, if you were to ask him, what does this mean? You know, he'd sit you down, well, I think, you know, I'm not going to do my David Lynch impression, but he would sit there and he would tell you, just what, I mean, actually, he probably wouldn't, but he'd know, thankfully. So, I mean, what type of thing do you think it is that you go after the most? I mean, anything ranging from childhood to spousal abuse or corporate America?
I have various themes. Right now, in my head, stuff that I'm chomping at the bit to make, and hopefully in the next couple of years, I have very large projects sitting in my cranium right now that I'm just so ready to start working on. They deal with issues of mental illnesses. I am becoming more and more obsessed with America's connection to censorship and how we censor things in this country and how we don't censor things that you think would be censored, and just the whole concept of censorship. And I'm dealing with this country not just because it's America versus everyone else, but I'm dealing with this country because I reside here and I am an American, and so this is the system that I see and know the most. And then I also am very interested in the concept of stereotypes, family dynamics, overclassification. There are many themes
which are partly responsible for censorship.
Exactly, and so everything's connected in a way. But I think it all has to do with human interaction at the core. If you had to pick one subject that my work approaches the most, it's human interaction.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm usually obsessed with is just the glaring absurdity of so much of what I see regularly. You know. Like one of my favorite movies is Ghost World, which is a movie of nothing but people like running into situations that are absolutely absurd, and just nobody else sees it. And but as far as censorship is concerned, I mean, that's not something that you really have to worry about all too much. You're not a big shock freak or anything like that. From what I've seen.
If there's one way that I can approach my work that might be shocking for me, I'm a very non-shocking individual, but I like to use humor as often as I can, especially when approaching more of a dark subject matter. If I can put a smile on your face, then you may stand in front of that work for an extra 10 seconds. It may seep into you just a little bit deeper, and you may think about it when you walk away.
Well, no, and your work has a great deal of subtlety to it. So, I mean, and of course, which was, you know, back in the days where censorship was really a problem, when there was a hell of a lot of it, and you couldn't see the nipple in the shower scene, or what, so on and so forth, or like the sex laws of the 30s in film. Keep going back to movies, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
But just even in photography, I'm pretty damn sure, I would only imagine, it had the same problem. That's when they had to rely on subtlety.
Yeah.
Entirely.
And I love subtlety. I mean, I'm a huge fan of the mystery of what's underneath instead of giving it all.
Which could be more offensive than the site itself.
Sure.
I mean, if you could have something that would, sort of indicate the casualties of war without having an actual picture of a corpse, which I think is another cop-out. It's sort of like the photographs of the homeless out on the street. It's people trying to express truth through a very, just sort of like hit you in the face with a sledgehammer. And while, yes, it's potent, it's powerful, because it is an image that evokes, you know, a great deal of startlement, it might almost be distracting from the truth or from the honesty of it. And
but sometimes honesty and raw truth is distracting, just because we don't like to look at the raw truth. And I fall into that category all the time. But I mean, subtlety for me is that, like, I have to watch myself, because I speak in metaphor. I mask everything about my life unintentionally most of the time, but sometimes very deliberate. But I think the reason that I like to use subtlety so much is that I don't, unless I absolutely want you to go in a specific direction, which I will do, I want you to develop your own idea as to what this image is that you're looking at, and take your own journey with my work, not necessarily my preconceived notion of what it is. And so subtlety is a great tool for that.
And it's ultimately it is your way. It is your presentation.
Sure.
It is your language, or however more broad and hippie-sounding ways you can put that.
Well, I mean, it's like, you know, just art in general and photography. We'll come back to the beginning, being self-taught. What I love about being self-taught versus, like I said, versus academia, because I don't know any other way, is that every day gets to be a new day. Nothing is not a surprise. And everything, every artist that I get to discover, like, I'll go up to a buddy of mine, and I feel like I've just discovered somebody's work for the first time, and I really want to talk about it. And I'll mention said artist to, a colleague of mine, and they'll go, "Erica, I studied them freshman year in college," and then I get to have a whole conversation with them. But I mean, I love that I get to be, you know, an 18-year-old kid every day in my mind.
Oh, and you can go on for hours, can't you?
Oh yeah,
easily. And that's just the joy. In fact, that's the joy of the arts, I guess. I would say I still wonder how a person could sit there and just talk about mathematics for 3 hours and their fascination.
Oh, they love it. Anybody, you know, and I admire those people, because I am absolutely horrible with numbers.
So. Yeah. I'd be interested in meeting a self-taught mathematician, which would be pretty awesome. Or a self-taught, well, I guess a self-taught linguist is not as unlikely. But, I mean, do you see yourself ever getting into motion? I mean,
I have two areas that, I started shooting video probably about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I went out and, you know, bought Final Cut Pro and started teaching myself the software. I was very intimidated and daunted by when I opened the box to Final Cut Pro. There wasn't just... I thought all the manuals were in different languages, but it turned out that they were all actually manuals to the software, which was a little intimidating because, let's be honest, if you have a group of four photographers and they have a new piece of equipment, The first thing they're going to pick up is the equipment, and the manual will be put in the box and shoved under the chair, and we will just hit all the buttons until something works.
Yeah, you basically monkey around with it until something falls out.
And that's kind of what we do. And no, but I have video projects already being developed. I have sound design is something that I'm very interested in, and I want to start combining multiple mediums with all based off of an image, a still image, and then develop it from there, from installation, to go so far as to even have projects that will involve actors and dance in the future, all based around one common theme. I do not see a single type of medium that I do not want to use and that I do not already have plans for in the future. But it all boils down to that one R word that seems to lock us in, and that's resources.
And that dusty manual.
Exactly. Well, and it actually, I'm staring into my office right now, and I'm pretty sure it still is dusty. So.
Well, I'll be damned. And are you a believer in the picture's worth a thousand words thing?
Definitely. I think that. And of course, I'm incredibly biased, so for those of you out there listening to this that don't agree with me, that's fine. But I think if you can take a serious subject matter and you could give them 1,000 words on that subject matter, but then you can start it with an image, you can at least... I think the two together are incredibly powerful, which is why we have them together all the time. And I think an image can set your mindset for where you want to go.
Well, how often is it more just about giving them imagery and just a single vision, and how much of it is a story? Does a story really even come into it?
With one particular image, are we going back to the...
Well, I suppose with a series of images that you could have some sort of chronology or at least an all-around theme that unifies them, and that has, a wider array of expression in terms of an idea. But as far as telling one photograph...
Yeah, one photograph, to me, I don't have... Like, I have different series of work, but sometimes my conceptual work, I only get one photograph to tell an entire story. One. There's one image. When I'm dealing with series of work, then I will develop it as a series, and you have to see it as a group in order to get the idea and the concept. But more often than not, you get one image to tell everything. And you asked if I am interested in getting into motion or anything like that. And all of my concepts, for the most part, in my brain, are in motion. They develop in motion. It's like a short film that plays in my head, and I will play it over and over again until I find that 1 second, that one brief
and
moment.
You have the context of the moment after and the moment before you took that
exactly.
shot.
Exactly. So it's like I love the challenge of having to get it just right.
Well, yeah, it's almost like finding, the diamond in the rough, or just, that you pluck out that 1 second or that one moment in the midst of an entire situation through the entire process of setting something up, even tearing it down, and somewhere in the midst of all of that. Do you at any times just go out, and we were talking about photojournalism either, do you find yourself compelled to, go to, say, for instance, I don't know, what's an event that happens that's worth photographing? Like, say, for instance, if you went to the state fair. It's a really simple example.
I go to the state fair every year with cameras. I absolutely love to shoot all the time. I don't bring a camera with me most of the time. I used to. I spent years where I had a camera with me everywhere I went. But I turned out that I was always looking for a certain composition, and I wasn't interacting with my world, and that's me personally. And so I stopped carrying a camera so much. I've gotten back into it, but now it's smaller, more intimate cameras. I rarely bring like a big digital SLR with me. I'll bring toy cameras like a Holga or a Diana, or I have a Lomo. Or, they're very small. I can fit multiple cameras into a bag.
Yeah, is it because the situation doesn't engage you as much? Because there's like a more of a disconnect? Or there's just less of an intimacy when you go over there and you haven't really quite formed a rapport with the people? Or that you just don't feel at home in sense of it? Like, so therefore you're not going to bring a camera that's, more, technically superior?
Well, it's a lot about... I missed several opportunities when I was younger. I've had some people in my life that have moved away or whatnot, and just for an example, if I always had a camera with me, I wasn't talking or interacting with my life. And I was so focused, because when I put a camera up to my face, I disappear from everybody else. I can't help but disappear. I get so focused in what I'm doing. And so, especially if I'm traveling or I'm on a trip, like, the person has to be incredibly patient that's with me, or I go off on my own. I love to go shoot on my own or with other photographers, because...
Or they'll be with you for half of the trip, or you'll be with them for half
of the trip. Yeah, because it's just, it's too much for other people, and I think that's why I don't carry a camera as much. I like to be with the people in my life, and so...
I suppose that was a lesson that you learned at some point, you know, that when you came to the conclusion, or you realized after you'd come home that you'd hardly been there at that event, that you had actually gone to enjoy.
Yeah.
But
when you have to relive your experience through the images you took instead of remembering what actually happened, it's, you know, but that, you know, that's for me personally. And I, the way that I like to work is that I concept off of my interaction in the world. And so I want to be in tune with my interaction and as much as possible.
And so the studio work is actually a culmination of that. It's after you've sort of... you've gathered that, and then you bring it back and you piece it together and do that, as opposed to it just being an improvised momentary thing.
Right, and what I do bring with... I never leave the house without something to write on. Well, actually, let's be honest, I do it quite often, and that's why there's like napkins strewn all across my boxes of journals and whatnot, full of concepts, but I get my ideas out in the world, and so instead of having a camera, the recorder that I like to bring out with me is a piece of paper and a pen.
Oh, absolutely! And do you see a really big new thing happening? I mean, I have my opinions about it in terms of just art in general, where all of art's going to go, where media is going to go. As far as this decade is concerned, I was complaining about it yesterday.
I'd be curious to see what you have to say, because I think at the core, with all the artists that I know and all the artists that I meet, and like I said, I'm still a baby at this, you know, I'm in, you know, eight, nine years of doing this and doing it for my living. I think artists at their core are artists, and so I'm taking it from an artist's perspective and not necessarily, you know, somebody looking in. I think that the ever-changing and the evolution of our technology is going to create drastically different work than we saw before. And I think the changes that we're having in video work right now are phenomenal. I was just up in Philadelphia this last weekend, and I went to the Fabric Workshop and Museum, and there were some video pieces on display, and they were just stunning.
The sheer capability.
Oh, they, yeah, what I do love, and a lot of people talk about how, like, we'll go back to photography, that with digital photography, that you can take 1,000 pictures and whatnot, and photography used to be incredibly expensive, but the beauty is now, is that people can take pictures, and you're going to get different work, because you have more people tackling the exact same struggle, and I think that change is going to advance us significantly, because art is very... We're competitive. We may act like we're not, but we are competitive. We all look at, you know, it's like you may stand there with your book and you're going to look at your friend and see their work and be like, oh, man, it's so good. And you genuinely mean that. And also on the inside, you're kind of seething a little bit and you want to go home and you want to go back to work. And that's
maybe
how...
Maybe do something better.
Maybe not. But we all push one another. And so if we have more people trying to produce work... a lot of people are talking about the dumbing down. But anytime there's a new introduction of a new medium, a new media source, we are going to have to sift through some fluff.
Yeah, and then there is kind of a chaos theory involved. I mean, there's no way that everybody's going to have these very easy-to-use tools, and everybody is going to you know, flush out and make great work because of, you know, the laws of the ratio of success, and that maybe, you know, you'll have to take less photographs, but so what? Maybe they have more time on their hands. And, I mean, I mainly ask not because there's something that you're going to, you know, hang your hat on or you're going to, you know, get on the train. But, I mean, as far as my opinion, there's an article I'm going to be writing about the low-quality renaissance, in which, about how we culturally have had new things, and it came to a point where we started to recycle things around, like, the 1990s, and things started making comebacks, and, you know, we started making movies out of, you know, television shows as quickly as we could, and it was this recycling and... Excuse me. It was this recycling of all of the things that had been made, and so the 1990s is going to become chaotic, and we special effects have gotten to the best that they're ever going to, or not. Maybe they'll get better, but after things like the Matrix trilogy, Lord of the Rings trilogy, just these pinnacles of you can sit there and watch an elf battle a troll, and it looks pretty damn good, and we're going to get fatigued over that, and we're going to return to just sort of a culmination of like grainy 80s camcorder video and Super 8 video.
Well,
and
sure, kinescope, the retro work, you know,
just, it's like... all going to get mixed up with each other. And there's already sort of an awakening in terms of music, in terms of film photography, of people sort of reverting back to this. And actually, I forget what these are, these photographs. And you still see them. The ones that
Are you talking about Polaroids?
The Polaroids.
Well, the Polaroid, it's kind of fascinating because I know that it's going to make a comeback, but the company went under. And so the reason you're seeing so much Polaroid...
And you wonder how.
Well, the reason you're seeing so much Polaroid, especially in the last year, is because it's no more. The white tab, the infamous white tab that we grew up with, the instant gratification of the Polaroid camera that everybody could have access to, is gone. And so in the last year, you know, I still have a drawer of it in my... my fridge, people always pick at me, my fridge is about one quarter food and about three quarters film. So, you know, you obviously see where my priorities lie. But, you know, Polaroid and the connection to retro, I think that in the fine art realm, there is a stronger connection to an alternative process right now. And I think it's because the commercial world, and I don't know if this is actual or not, but the commercial world is not using it at all anymore. And so it's kind of like, the retention, we're trying to hold on to it and to grasp
it. Yeah, I see it kind of as a full circle. And not so much as just saying, hey, don't you... And there is sort of a degree of that. Like, a lot of musicals, sort of like these days, I've been hearing a lot of music lately that employs, like, 8-bit sounds from the NES.
Sure.
And some of it is nostalgia. Some of it is coming back, like, oh, hey, don't you remember this? Oh, remember back when you were 5, when you were 10? Remember this song that you heard? We made a remix out of it, or we put it underneath some hip-hop song. But I think that what is also becoming is just sort of a crunching together of it. It's sort of like, you know, paper pulping, you know, which is a bunch of stuff is shredded up, and it's put back together, and it just goes from different realms of quality and time to the point that it becomes this new animal. And I've never been a really big fan of collage, but that's kind of what...
Well, you know, we live in a societal fusion right now. I mean, like, we like to fuse anything we can, you know, whether it be cuisine, whether it be art. You know, it's like, I fuse multiple mediums together, you know, instead of sticking to one true. And I think if you had to pick a movement that we're big on right now, it's definitely, it's, you know... We're crossing paths as many things as we can, and we're bringing back, I think for a lot of artists, you know, I'm in my early 30s, like, we're going to bring back, like, things that we remember from Atari, you know, like, the 80s were a big deal to us, and mm-hmm. they're going to get thrown into our work, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I see it as being just this sort of a rediscovery and just this big jumbled mess of stuff, and it'll be very sincere and very, very nice. Well, it's been an hour, and it's been a real pleasure talking to you, Erica.
Likewise, RJ. Thanks
and,
for coming.
Yeah, absolutely. And your website?
You can find my work at ericafelicella.com, www.ericafelicella.com.
Thank you.